Third case, United States v. Johnson. Ms. Schranz?
May it please the Court? I want to address two errors in the district court that denied Mr. Johnson his right to a fair trial.
Could you speak a little louder?
I apologize. I have a cold. I'll try and speak up a little bit. I want to address two errors in the district court that denied Mr. Johnson his right to a fair trial. The first of those is relating to, the jury instruction requiring unanimity on Mr. Johnson's alleged managerial role in the criminal enterprise. The second issue is the court's admission of Mr. Johnson's alleged prior bad acts that predated the time period of the conspiracy, and its failure to really address the danger of unfair prejudice to Mr. Johnson from the admission of that evidence.
The jury has to be unanimous as to which people he supervised, or just has to be unanimous that there were, six, whatever is required?
Five.
That there were five or more?
It's our view that at a minimum, every juror had to agree that Mr. Johnson managed at least five individuals in the enterprise. We think in this case that it would...
I think a maximum also. I don't think they have to agree on the individuals.
No, they don't. And we've said we understand the law in this circuit does not require...
It was instructed on unanimity, wasn't it? I wasn't clear what more you wanted.
The jury was given a general unanimity instruction, which...
What do they need?
Well, I mean, virtually every criminal case, every crime, you have a general unanimity instruction.
Right.
And if you only needed that, then you wouldn't have cases like Richardson or Gibbs.
Didn't you say they had to be unanimous on each element?
They had, it was unanimity on each count, not on each element of the CCE offense.
But how can a jury reach a unanimous verdict on any particular count without unanimously agreeing on all of the required elements of the offense of that count?
Well, it's the issue raised in Richardson, which is unless you instruct them that they're required to go element by element, that they're required to really consider whether on this specific statutory element Mr. Johnson managed at least five individuals, they might just fall in.
Is there any doubt that he managed at least five?
Your Honor, there is. There was conflicting testimony presented for a number of the government's...
The drug boss of Quincy, Illinois?
I'm sorry, I think we're...
The drug boss of Illinois?
Well, that's the picture...
Of Quincy? Quincy is?
That's the picture the government tried to present.
Well, a lot of evidence of that.
There was certainly a number of witnesses who testified, and there were some who consistently testified, but there were a number who gave conflicting testimony about what their relationship was with Mr. Johnson during the time period of the charged conduct.
Yeah, but the government presented sufficient evidence that five of the witnesses were co-conspirators. These witnesses also mentioned between two and eight other dealers that could have been managed by Mr. Johnson. So there was ample evidence, it would seem, that a jury could use to find that Mr. Johnson managed or supervised at least five others. And as we know from the Hardin case, it doesn't matter if each of the jurors had a different five in mind.
I disagree that there was sufficient evidence on at least five. Now, we're not making a sufficiency of the evidence argument. What we're saying is there was at least contradictory evidence presented for a number of these witnesses that any one juror could have concluded that those witnesses were not part of the five, and that would get you down to under the five, which is the minimum required by the statute. The key here is that
Quincy. What's the population of Quincy?
I actually have no idea, Your Honor.
I think it's around 100,000.
Uh-huh. I was wondering how, because the bigger it is, the more plausible it is that he had a staff, since he obviously was a big figure in the Quincy crime scene.
I think the critical issue on the CC jury instruction is that the CCE offense is not your garden variety drug offense. It is a broad, complex statutory crime. It carries a mandatory minimum sentence of 20 years to life. And that's why this court...
Well, it's nice to see the government going after a big drug dealer for a change rather than the little people that they find it easier to convict.
I don't agree that Mr. Johnson is a big drug dealer. Kevin Turner, who was his supplier in Chicago, was, by all accounts, the big drug dealer, and he testified that Mr. Johnson was one of his most insignificant customers. I think the critical issue here is that, given the complexity of the CCE offense, Mr. Johnson was entitled to have the jury instructed, as this court requires, that each juror must agree on his managerial role in the offense. They were not given that instruction. The court gave no explanation for why it didn't give the instruction. The government, who had tendered the instruction and then withdrew it, gave no explanation for why they withdrew it. And so it simply wasn't given, and it should have been.
You know, it strikes me there's a tension between your two arguments, this and the bad acts, because what you complain about in the bad acts is an effort to show the evolution of the drug business in Quincy and how Johnson became the big shot and so on. And if you got all that evidence out, it would be more difficult for the government to make a plausible case that he's supervised at least five people.
I disagree, and here's why. There's certainly an appropriate reason to admit evidence prior to the alleged conspiracy, to show the relationship of the parties, to make your case that there's a conspiracy. That's not what happened here. What happened here went well beyond that. This was basically an open door, in part because it was a CCE offense, which has such a broad-ranging offense. The government was essentially given an open door to admit every piece of evidence through its witnesses about Mr. Johnson's alleged prior misconduct. And, for example, they had a witness testify in 1993 that he talked to Mr. Johnson about selling drugs while they were in jail together. That is not a necessary fact to show their relationship. That had the danger of unfairly prejudicing Mr. Johnson with a jury and presenting him as someone who was basically a bad guy.
One of the five?
Well, that was Nolan Nelson. And our position is there's evidence from which a jury could conclude he wasn't part of the five, given the 2000 to 2002
time. Was it the government's theory that he was part of the...
He was. That was the government's theory.
That's their basis for wanting to have the full history of his relationship with Johnson.
Yes. But the fact that they discussed it in jail is the...
But what it shows is, discussed in jail. They're pals. They're in jail together. They're pals. It makes sense that when they come out, they're going to have a business relationship.
You know, some of that... history with Nolan Nelson, I thought, kind of helped Johnson. I mean, the prior relationship evidence demonstrated that at times in the past, they were equal partners in drug endeavors.
Well, exactly, Your Honor, and there's actually...
Well, so that, so that he wasn't his,
creature.
Supervisor. I thought that sort of helped him.
There was evidence presented that even that during the time period of the charged conduct, that they had a falling out, they weren't working together, at times they were sort of at equal level, and we think that's evidence from which the jury could conclude he wasn't one of the five managed during the time period. Again, we're not saying that all evidence to show relationship was improperly admitted.
What's the worst bad act in your view?
I think Mary Green is by far the worst bad act. She was not alleged to be part of the conspiracy in any way. She testified that she stole toddlers' clothing in years prior to the charged conduct for Mr. Johnson, They asked details about which store did you go to, what type of clothing did you steal. This was an effort to really, I think, inflame the jury and present him as a...
For him to wear or what?
This was not for Mr. Johnson to wear, but presumably for, you know, a child, either a nephew or that he compelled her to steal.
It could also have demonstrated that he was a caring father. No, really.
But I don't think that's why the government presented it.
Well, it may not be why, but.
And more, I think the key point is this. There is nothing in the record that shows the court did the proper balancing, didn't consider what the danger of unfair prejudice was to Mr. Johnson. The court determined that this evidence was probative and relevant and didn't bother to weigh the unfair prejudice. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Schrantz. Mr. Hartzler?
Good morning. Joe Hartzler for the United States. Mm-hmm. I think that you could probably do the web search for the population of Quincy while we're speaking, but I think 100,000 is a high estimation. My guess is it's somewhere in the range of 35,000 to 50,000. They have one large public high school. Springfield has 120,000. We have 3.5 public
high
schools.
Wow, it's really lost population since I worked for the state. Wow.
Hmm. Well, as I say, I could be wrong. I'm basing it on my experience of my son playing high school basketball and traveling to Quincy. I appreciate and hope to be able to address the issues the court has raised, but I'm also hopeful that you'll consider the Rule 30 issue that was raised in our brief, which is the question of forfeiture of the issue of the jury instruction. The importance, obviously, is that we would hope there wouldn't be a rule of law that would enable a defendant to come before the Court of Appeals and complain about the district court's failure to give an instruction that the defendant himself did not request. Conceitedly, it's a pattern instruction, but there are an awful lot of pattern instructions, and we wouldn't want to see a setup whereby the prosecution or the district court felt compelled to go through the pattern jury instruction book and confirm that the various pattern instructions that might arguably be relevant are not requested by the defendant. I understand the argument, the suggestion throughout that this is an instruction that Mr. Johnson definitely, absolutely would have wanted, but if you don't mind my reading just a portion of it, there's really only one sentence in this proposed instruction that Mr. Johnson could conceivably have wanted. The rest of the instruction reads, those persons do not have to be named in the indictment. You do not have to agree on the identity of five or more persons. You do not have to find that five or more persons act together at the same time. It was not required that the defendant acted in concert with five or more in the commission of a single offense. You do not have to find that the defendant had the same relationship with each of the five. It's not all that favorable to the defendant whatsoever, except for that one sentence that says, you must unanimously agree that he supervised five or more people. And I think that if I am interpreting the questions from the court correctly, there's no question that this jury understood that the government was obliged to prove each and every element beyond a reasonable doubt, and for every count, the jury had to be unanimous. And indeed, for the CCE count, they had to be unanimous on each of the violations that was alleged. You recall that the verdict form became listed each of the various violations. I think it referred to the other counts. So the jurors clearly were unanimous as to the violations that were incorporated, the predicate offenses for the CCE.
Could you comment on the Mary Green testimony?
I thought the Mary Green testimony went too far only in one small respect, and it didn't have to do with her shoplifting. I mean, there are lots of consequences to crack addiction, and some of them might arguably be inflammatory. But the fact that someone shoplifts to serve their crack addiction is far from the most prejudicial evidence the government...
No, but what is the probative value of the evidence?
Well, the probative value is simply to explain where she could come up with funds, where this woman that was not employed could come up with the funds to be a regular purchaser of crack.
But what was the relevance to that? I don't understand. To Johnson's guilt. How does Mary Green...
Mary Green was one of his regular customers. It simply fills out the story of who Mary Green is to the jury. When Mary Green...
Why do we want to know who Mary Green is? I don't understand. What?
She was a customer of... She bought crack cocaine directly from...
So this is to show that Johnson sells crack cocaine?
Right.
You call a customer.
I believe...
So why doesn't she just say she bought cocaine for him? Why do the clothes get into it? Or... the addictive effects. I don't understand that.
You're not persuaded by my point that when the witness is on the witness stand, there is a question as to who this person is and how they could conceivably be a regular purchaser of crack cocaine.
You mean the jury might have thought she couldn't afford to buy?
She's unemployed. I believe the testimony was she should not have a job, I believe. Yes. Yeah, typically we would call somebody and say, I'm a life insurance salesman and I bought crack cocaine and I spent however many dollars it was per week on my serving my habit to buy crack cocaine. She didn't have a job, is my best recollection from the transcript. And they explained. Now, did it go too far in terms of her explaining where she shoplifted the clothes and how she had hooks underneath her clothes? That probably was unnecessary, but it prejudiced Mary Green more than it prejudiced Mr. Johnson. And also, I think in the context of the whole trial, it was very limited testimony. I think she was probably the shortest witness that the government called. She was only on the witness stand for all of 28 pages, and the shoplifting testimony was a much smaller portion of that.
But since she wasn't alleged to be part of the conspiracy, how were her drug dealings with Johnson prior to the year 2000 relevant?
They simply showed the background. She was not a co-conspirator, correct?
See, I really am concerned that evidence of Johnson's intent was sliding into evidence of Johnson's propensity to commit crime. It does indeed... seem that the government was trying to demonstrate that because the defendant, you know, was determined to sell drugs in the past, he would have the same inclination to do so now. How do we separate the intent from the propensity here?
I appreciate your pressing me on Mary Green. I'm prepared to concede that that is the most problematic evidence. There's no question about it. It went too far. The issue is, did that evidence, in the context of this trial, create such prejudice against Mr. Johnson that it influenced this verdict? Mary Green's testimony could well have been limited to the conspiracy period. The government could have established through her testimony that she was a direct purchaser of cocaine from Mr. Johnson. That would have been probative, would have been relevant, that would have been appropriate testimony. Having gone outside of the conspiracy period and going into further detail about the shoplifting was probably inappropriate. So you're asking me to defend something that I'm prepared to concede, stepping back from it, year after the trial, looking at the full record, yes, amicus counsel has identified what you could characterize as the weakest point in this case, Mary Green's testimony. Not all the testimony, but a small portion of Mary Green's testimony.
Well, since the case is going to be vacated in any event and remanded
the sentence
for resentencing in light of Kimbrough, I mean, is the Mary Green testimony, would the government concede that that should not be considered as well at the same time?
Oh, that's a good point. I haven't reviewed the PSR to see what the pre-sentence report to see whether or not that was even included. I don't can't imagine it's a small amount of crack cocaine that she purchased from Mr. Johnson would have any impact on his sentence. But if it does, I understand that the pre-sentence report would include that. Well, it would be relevant conduct, though. Anything she bought is going to be relevant conduct.
But not if it's so tainted by this.
No, it's only tainted.
Over the top.
No, yeah, but that's only addressing Judge Posner's question about the probative value in this case and the fact she's not a co-conspirator. That's not going to affect the sentencing. It's still going to be considered relevant conduct for sentencing purposes. But Your Honor, I honestly do not believe that the amount of cocaine, crack cocaine, that Mary Greene purchased when totaled is going to have a significant effect on the guideline range. I mean, the amount that was purchased by Mr. Johnson from Kevin Turner is going to lead to a very, very sizable guideline range under the drug guidelines. And the amount that is added on for Mary Greene's is probably not going to be all that significant if it's there, and I don't know that it is.
Great. Okay. Anything more, Mr. Hartzler?
I see that my time is up. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And Ms. Trantz, you have, or would you like a minute? Does she have any time? Do you have anything further? Sure.
I just want to emphasize one more time that because this is a CCE offense, this was not your garden variety drug case. The issues about Mary Greene are important. Mary Greene, the government referenced, previewed her testimony with their very first witness at trial, Nolan Nelson. So early on from the beginning, it was clear that the government intended to present Mr. Johnson as someone so horrible that he would have a crack addict steal toddler's clothing so that she could get crack from him. And all of this, the failure of the court to give the pattern jury instruction, the failure of the court to do the proper balancing test and evaluate the danger of unfair prejudice from witnesses like Mary Greene and other testimony about alleged prior misconduct, all of it underscores the importance of the trial court to follow the rules, which it didn't do here. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you, Ms. Rance. And we thank you for your service to the court as amicus curiae and your excellent efforts on behalf of your client.